From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Why do some children succeed and others fail? Paul Tough went looking for the answer to that question and in the process learned that that answer is changing. Paul Tough, a familiar voice to public radio listeners for his contributions to This American Life. He's reported on character and childhood for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. And the new book is called How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. We used to think we knew how to get children to succeed, as you relate in this book. And it was called the cognitive hypothesis. What is that and how did we think it worked?
So the cognitive hypothesis is the name that I give to the conventional wisdom that I think guides a lot of us, that the one characteristic that really matters in a child's success is IQ. It's that sort of narrow band of cognitive skills that gets measured on achievement tests. And I think we've thought this for a long time, and I think that it's behind our obsession with test scores, both in terms of individual families and as a nation. But the scientists and educators who I am writing about in this book have identified a different set of skills that they say are more important.
And how they found out we were off the track, I think, was kind of interesting. One of the things they did is they looked at the GED tests, which people could take instead of going to school to get a high school degree. And they found out from taking a look at what those students did after they got their GEDs that there was kind of a flaw in that method, right?
Exactly. So this is the work of an economist at the University of Chicago named James Heckman. He's one of the central characters in the book. And about 12 years ago, he was looking at the GED results. And the GED is sort of the perfect expression of the cognitive hypothesis. It says that if you have the smarts to graduate from high school, then you're a high school graduate. You just take this test and you don't need to do anything else. And you can go on to do everything that a high school graduate can do. So Heckman wanted to try to figure out if that premise was true or not. So he took a look at some big data sets that involved high school dropouts, GED holders, and high school graduates. And what he found is that part of the premise was definitely true, that the GED holders had just as much intelligence. Their IQ scores were just as high as the high school graduates. And yet when he looked at their course through life in terms of what happened to them after they got their GEDs, they weren't doing well at all. In fact, they were doing exactly the same as the high school dropouts in terms of their educational attainment, how likely they were to be arrested, to be on welfare. And so he concluded that there was something that was missing, that there was some trait, some skills that were involved in getting a high school diploma that, A, were very important, and B, weren't captured in getting a GED.
And these were the things that are in the subtitle of your book, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Now, people hear character in education, and they might think, oh, we're talking about instilling people in certain religious values. But you're talking about a different kind of character here, aren't you?
I am. One of the tricky things about writing about this is that we don't have really a great acceptable phrase for these traits. And so economists call them, like Heckman, call them non-cognitive skills. Not a very evocative phrase. There's also the problem that it turns out a lot of these skills are cognitive, so non-cognitive is a really bad word for them. Character in lots of ways, I think is a better term. But you're right, it's problematic as well, partly because I think a lot of us think of character as having to do with values and ethics, and that's not how the educators who I'm writing about use it. The other thing is I think that we tend to think that character is something that's fixed, that you just have good character or you're not, you're one kind of kid or you're another kind of kid. And the scientists and educators I'm writing about are arguing for a very different definition of character. They're saying that it's a set of skills that makes people effective and that they're very much malleable, they're teachable. Children can change them themselves, but also parents and teachers have a huge amount of an effect on how children develop character.
And as you related, these ideas are going into effect in many schools, often many charter schools, dealing with particularly difficult students to educate. And maybe give us some example of what it means to try to teach character or to try to teach grit.
Well, one of the main experiments that I write about in the book is going on in New York City right now with two very different schools. One, a KIPP charter middle school serving mostly low-income kids in West Harlem. The other, the Riverdale Country School, which is an elite private school, one of the more expensive schools in New York City. And together they have worked with a team of psychologists from the University of Pennsylvania to come up with seven character strengths that they are trying to teach. So they include grit, self-control, curiosity, optimism, gratitude, social intelligence. And So they're using different methods to try to teach them. No one's quite sure how best to teach character strengths. But what they're doing at KIPP is they've got a character report card. Report card's a bit of a misnomer. You do get assessed on all these character strengths by each of your teachers, but you don't, you know, get held back a year if you fail gratitude. It's much more of a conversation piece. It's a way to talk to kids about character and to talk to them about it in the context of growth. So I think for especially for kids in middle school, they believe and they hear the message that they're never going to change, that you know, these traits are just things that they're always going to have. And by showing them, you know, here's what people think you're doing, how people think you're doing on curiosity or zest or grit, and here's how you can improve, that I think is a powerful message to these kids that things can change.
Okay, if they buy the idea that I can change, they're not kind of tossed into helplessness, then how do you actually convey to them, how do they get gritty?
Well, so grit, I think, and again, this is part of the complication of trying to teach this stuff. You know, you can talk to kids about grit for sure. You can explain, you know, one of the ways they do it is in English class and history class. They talk about characters in history or in literature who have got grit. Grit in this case meaning, you know, perseverance, but perseverance with passion. But one of the things that I think is most true about trying to help kids develop these skills came from my reporting at Riverdale, the rich private school. And I think one of the ways that kids learn about grit is through failing, is through having the experience of trying something and failing. And in fact, it was the headmaster at Riverdale who said to me that, you know, the reason he was so concerned about the grit in his students is that at schools like his, high-achieving schools like his, no one really has an opportunity to fail.
And parents don't want them to fail, right? They think exactly. That's going to harm their self-esteem.
Yeah, hurt their self-esteem, hurt their chances of getting into college. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are really hyper-competitive schools. And so one of the reasons at this school why they started down this character path was this sense that they were creating kids who were great at taking tests, who were very accomplished in all sorts of ways, who, you know, could deal with pressure and stress but couldn't deal with real challenges. And so as a result, they hadn't had the opportunity to try to develop these important character strengths like grit.
Paul Tough is my guest. We're talking about how children succeed. It's the title of his new book that looks at kind of a revolution in the way that we can get children to succeed. So, and we're at 206-543-5869. If you've got a question, it's toll-free 800-289-5869, or you can write conversation at kuow.org. So that's how these ideas of character were kind of implemented at the rich kids' school. But you also talk a lot about, and this was fascinating to me, the difficulties that poor kids have, which have been well documented, but you even take it to a deeper level, these traumatic childhoods that they have lived through. There's been a lot of work at what actually happens to their nervous systems and what's going on inside, something called the firehouse effect. What's going on there?
So you're right. So I think we've known for a long time that growing up in poverty is not good for kids.
Right.
It's harmful to them in all kinds of ways, but we haven't known exactly why. And the science that makes the most sense to me that I think is really behind what's happening with a lot of poor kids is the science of stress, the biology of stress. And this is something where neuroscientists have made huge strides over the last few decades. We really now understand better than we did before how the stress system is formed and how important it is, especially in the first few years of life. It's good for us to have, and for babies even, to have some stress, that having, you know, being startled, being a little stressed out, and then calming yourself down, whether you're an infant or a child or a grown-up, that's sort of like exercising a muscle. It's a good thing. But for a lot of kids growing up in particularly disadvantaged homes, stress is just a constant companion, and there's just way too much noise, violence, instability, adversity of all kinds. And what it does is it doesn't sort of build up the stress response system. It decays it. It really harms it. And you can see this in brain scans of kids when they've been exposed to a lot of what the scientists call toxic stress growing up. It actually changes the size and shape of certain parts of their brain.
This was incredible because we already know about addiction and suicide and depression coming out of these traumatic childhoods, but they got deeper and they realize it affects children's health as they grow up beyond those activities. There's something inside them that's really harmed. Could you explain that?
Sure. So this comes out of this study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, and it started as a medical study. They asked doctors asked 17,000 patients to just list the number of adverse experiences they'd had, and then compared that with their medical records. And the ones who had high so-called ACE scores, you're right, not only had these behavioral problems, but also had higher cancer rates, higher heart disease rates, higher liver disease rates, and all, you know, not having to do with any
addiction or anything like that. Exactly. It was just going on to the side of that.
Exactly. And so what these stress scientists have figured out is that that's about the way that the stress system gets overloaded by this childhood trauma. So it has a profound effect on physical health. What they've also found is that it has a real effect on mental health. Early childhood trauma tends to make people more depressed and anxious. And most important, in the educational context, it also has an effect on this set of cognitive skills known as executive functions, which are sort of our ability to organize our thoughts. This one psychologist calls it the air traffic control center for your brain. It's your ability to take in new information, to sit still, to organize your thoughts. And those things are all really important on the first day of kindergarten and all the way through school. And when kids come into school having had traumatic first few years of life and not having had the experience of learning how to manage stress, it's really difficult for them to succeed in a school context without some serious interventions.
Another of the things you look at is how parents and how people who work with parents have been able to help them in working with their children. I mean, it's been assumed that reading to your child is a really great thing to do, and certainly it is in a lot of different cases. But you talk about a study that looked at attachment between parent and child as being more important than any other strategies. Like, how does that play into this theme of character?
Yeah, I was really struck by that, by those studies. So that stress is very important, but there is this kind of antidote to stress when kids are growing up, and that is parents. That when parents are able to form a close, nurturing bond known as attachment with their kids, it protects children from even some very serious amounts of stress growing up. And how that connects to character, in some ways, that's really what I'm trying to do in this book, is connect the neuroscientific research with what's going on in education. And to say that, you know, one of the things that these neuroscientists have learned is that underneath adult psychology, underneath all these sort of nuanced characteristics that we call character, are actually the infant brain chemistry. It's the simple interaction of chemicals in an infant's brain, and that the best way to create an adult or an adolescent who is, you know, prudent and brave and well-adjusted is to make sure that their stress response system is protected in those first few years of life.
Now, this idea of training children in grit and getting their grit and their curiosity and their character working together has some critics. And there are those who you recount who say it's kind of turning kids into drones. They're just all becoming little workaholics to kind of get things done and devoted. And what do you think about that criticism? Is it valid?
I think it is. I think it is valid. One of the things I find interesting, so the KIPP schools are a pretty well-known set of charter schools. And I started reporting on them way back in 2006. And they've really changed over those years. And I think that they've changed in terms of their thinking about character. And 6 years ago, what character was at KIPP really did have a lot to do with self-control. It was all about sort of following rules, following directions, controlling your impulses. And there's certainly clear evidence that knowing how to do that is really a good thing, that when you're, you know, conscientious when you're conscientious or able to regulate yourself, you do better in all kinds of ways. But I think there's also the case that, like, that's not really a full definition of success, simply being able to regulate yourself. And so the character strengths that KIPP is trying to teach now include some things like zest, curiosity, optimism, things that in the middle school context are actually kind of in tension with self-control. You know, mm-hmm. If you're a middle school teacher, you don't necessarily want a room full of zesty middle school students. So I think a narrow look at self-regulation is potentially, I don't know about harmful, but certainly not really a full vision of character. But what I like about this new era in thinking about character is that it's pushing beyond that into a whole range of character strengths.
Now, someone listening, I'm sure, heard you say the idea of instilling optimism in children. How do you do that? Write optimism 50 times on the board? How do you do that?
Well, a lot of this character research comes out of comes from some of the founders of this movement called positive psychology, again, at the University of Pennsylvania. And positive psychology is a really interesting idea. I feel like there are people who want to be sort of dour and pessimistic who are very skeptical about positive psychology, but it's not sort of just a naive, like, everything's going to be okay sort of optimism. It's about training kids and adults as well to frame the things that happen to them in as positive a way as possible.
It's about looking at things, not the things that are going wrong, but the things that are going right and emphasizing them, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the books that this psychologist Martin Seligman has written is called Learned Optimism. And he I think, makes a really good case that when you can teach kids to think about positive things more positively and to think of, you know, negative things that happen to you as not being personal or pervasive, but just temporary, kids do better. You know, it lets you go on. It lets you pick yourself up and try again. And I think there's really good evidence that you can train kids in this sort of resilience and optimism. And it doesn't change their lives entirely, but it's a great skill to have.
As you say, some of this research has been going on for decades, but a lot of it being implemented is relatively new, the last 4 or 5 years. How mature is this knowledge? Are we apt to find out, oh, we were wrong?
I don't think we're going to find out that it's all wrong, but it's definitely still a growing field. And the place where we certainly don't have the answers is in how to teach it. And so when I talk to teachers, I find they're often frustrated because they're like, okay, how do we teach grit? But there isn't a grit curriculum that you can take off the shelf. There's no, you know, curiosity worksheets that we can hand out and get things done. But I think there are a set of principles and ideas in this research that are really powerful. And there's still a lot more we have to learn. And I think certainly a lot more that we have to experiment with in terms of how to improve kids' lives along these, in terms of these traits. So I think we're heading in the right direction, but we're not there.
Paul Tough, you're a dad?
I am.
So have you been doing some experimenting with your child?
I have. So my son is 3. And so just as he was born, I started getting into all this research. I had the weird experience of, you know, reading neuroscience papers during the day about the importance of the first year of life and then like rolling around with him on the floor in the evenings and trying not to let him, you know, get too self-conscious and turn him into my experimental subject. But it's hard not to. And I really spent a lot, especially of those first couple of years. You know, I think when he was born, I was like a lot of parents. I was in the grip of the cognitive hypothesis, thinking that, you know, I had to get him the Mozart CDs and the Baby Einstein videos. But in lots of ways, this research calmed me down and made me think, you know, those early years are definitely important, but I think really they're important in terms of the relationship between the infant and his parents or other adults in his life. And so that part was kind of fun. I was able to just concentrate on helping him develop his stress response system, which happens to be, you know, about playing and communicating and having a lot of face-to-face time.
Well, Paul Tough, How Children Succeed is a wonderful book. It's an interesting science story. It's well told with great examples and characters of the people. We kind of follow them as they kind of gain some more understanding of what it is you're talking about. Even despite the fact you've written the book on it and researched it, we're just about out of time, but is there some big overriding question you still have that you haven't answered yet?
Good question. I mean, I think there's still some interesting questions about how to activate this, you know. Mm-hmm. I think partly it's about which character strengths are easiest to teach or most important to teach for kids. But I think we're on our way to finding out some important answers.
Paul Tough, great having you by. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Paul Tough, the book's called How Children Succeed. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.